Rishis, the Rosh Hashiva and the Rabbanim. The topic that I'm going to try to talk about is a hugely important topic, a very important topic. Every time that I try to let myself run away from it, I would speak to another person in America or hear another story that would shake me up and push myself to speak about this topic. So although it's a scary topic to touch upon because of how I think enormous of an issue that it is, it's one that I think we need to talk about. The Gemara in Kiddushin on Pei Aleph and Aleph tells a bunch of stories that when you read them make you feel uncomfortable enough that you'd rather just keep on reading on and not have to figure out what's going on over there exactly. One such story that it starts with, it's stories of Tanaim. And one such story that it starts with is a story of Rav Amram Chasida. To be called Chasida, to be a Chasid, requires a lot, especially on the part of in the days of the Tanaim. So it says that he had encouraged people to save a certain group of women that were taken into captivity. And because of that, when the women were sent back, they kept them in his attic in order that there shouldn't be any yichud. So the ladder was moved away to get to the attic, and that ladder would have taken 10 people to be able to carry and move it over for him to get to that attic and climb up to those women. At one point in time, somehow the Gemara is describing the situation how one of the girls moved upstairs in a certain way where light shone upon her. He saw her for a moment, and with the energy that it usually would take 10 strong people to move a ladder, he himself went, moved the ladder, and started climbing up to these women. In the middle, on the way, something, he caught hold of himself. The Gemara says he separated his legs and held himself in place and screamed, "Fire, fire, fire," in the house of Rav Amram, until all of his Tamidim and people from the community came by and they realized what had happened. There was no fire at all, but in fact he was trying to save himself from going further by creating this embarrassing situation. The Tamidim were embarrassed by his behavior, and he said, "I'd rather embarrass you in this world and embarrass myself in this world than suffer embarrassment in the next world." The Gemara goes on and tells about Rabbi Akiva. It says Rabbi Akiva used to ridicule or make light of the struggle of people that have a taiva, of people that would run after the pulls of the Yetzirah. And because of that, the Satan, the Yetzirah, wanted specifically to challenge Rabbi Akiva in an extra difficult way, to put him in his place, as if to say. And he appeared as a woman in a tree right in the way of where Rabbi Akiva was walking. And something came over Rabbi Akiva. He saw her and he started to climb the tree to go to the woman, until HaKadosh Baruch Hu stopped the Satan in his tracks. And the Satan said, "Had they not made an announcement in Shemayim to leave Rabbi Akiva alone, I would have made you worth 2 coins. I was about to devalue you completely from the great, tremendous level that you're on." And they tell a similar story about Rabbi Meir, and elsewhere in Shas, the stories about some other Tanaim. And when we read this, we think, you know, I talk to girls a lot. I see them. I pass them in the street. I'm not running across the street, you know, after any girl. I've been in a room with a girl before and didn't do anything. Why is it? I don't understand. What was it that the situation that these Tanaim were in, where they couldn't handle it, and I, at least 90 hopefully percent of the time, if not more, am able to stop myself from these type of situations? So usually, when you're in the face of a sin, it's too hard to fight at that moment. The way that we fight sin, and what usually keeps us away from sinning, is all the things that we would need to go through in order to get to the place of the sin. A person would need to hide. He might need to make certain lies up, disappear, dress a certain way. He's afraid of the shame, the guilt, the seeing people, what will people think, being caught, and the money that's involved. And there's a lot of difficulty usually going in the way of big sins that keep us from doing it, traveling to certain places, and involves a certain amount of risks involved. And those are usually things that keep a person from doing something. The Gemara gives an example of a father who took his son, dressed him up nicely, put nice perfume on him, gave him a lot of money, and put him right outside of a house of zonos, of a house of prostitutes, who are looking just to come to him. So the Gemara says, "Ma yasa oto ben velo yachta." What's that son going to do? He's not going to sin. You took away everything that stops a person from coming towards a sin. There's nothing in his way. The sin is right there. Of course he's going to sin. It's almost not even that kid's fault anymore. The fact that the father put him over there. By the way, a little bit of a side tangent. There's a lot of statements in Chazal that seem to be very striking and upsetting, and we don't really understand what's the comparison. For example, the Gemara says, "Kala koes ki'ilu ovir avodah zarah." Anybody that gets angry, it's like he's worshiping avodah zarah. "Kala mal bin pnei chaver barabim." If you embarrass somebody publicly, "shofech damim." It's like you're murdering, you're killing somebody. "Kala dover lashon hara." If you speak lashon hara, it's like you're having bia with all the arayos in the world. Etc., etc., etc. There's tons of chazals that compare things that we know are bad and insensitive and wrong, but in a million years we never would have compared it to the stringency of the thing that they're comparing it to. And clearly they want to awaken that shock by us. But what do they mean exactly if they don't mean it literally? So what chazal are saying is that really inside your personality and where you're holding your character, you would do those things. And the reason why you're not doing it is because all the difficulty involved in it. If you were to kill somebody, you'll probably get caught and go to jail, feel very embarrassed in front of a lot of people, you'll feel personally guilty to yourself. If you never have to see him again, you could just press a button, blip, there doesn't have to be any blood, you don't have to get a knife, nobody will ever know that you pressed that button and he disappeared just to say a word that embarrasses him and makes him feel like nothing, that you're ready to do. If it's cheap and easy and nobody needs to know about it, you'll never get caught and it's not difficult, then you would have done it. The reason why you're not doing it is because all the steps that would take to get to that, they're the ones that are keeping you from that. But you should know that if you're doing those sins, you're speaking lashon hara, you're getting angry or embarrassing somebody publicly, you're in the same path as somebody that does the thing at the end of the line. Hitler got tons of Germans to become Nazis and do things that in a million years, how do you get a human being to do that thing? And it could be had Hitler not created in a situation that would make it easy and okay for the Nazis to behave the way they did, I don't think you'd have all the tens of thousands of Nazis that did terrible crimes and things like that go ahead and on their own do it. He made it easy, he made it available, he made you not have to feel guilty, but rather feel proud about you, what you were doing, and enable them to do monstrous things that are deeply embedded within every person, the ability to do that. Another thing about when a person goes to do a sin, the moment the person makes that decision, I'm going to sin anyway, and he's going to disregard the things that are blocking between him and the sin, so there's a conversation that theoretically goes on in his mind. On one hand, the person says to himself, "You can't do that. That's not going to be good. There's going to be different ramifications. You don't believe in what it is that you're doing." So what is the Yetzer Hara? What do we say to that Yetzer Tov trying to get us to stop and do the right thing? What's our response to the Yetzer Hara? So Chazal tell us that what we do to the Yetzer Hara, what the Yetzer Hara does, the Yetzer Tov, is it just ignores him. Doesn't listen to him whatsoever, pushes him to the back of his mind and shuts him up. Doesn't let him keep on talking. He keeps on moving and going towards the sin and puts himself into a state of a trance. He makes himself stupid. He stops himself from thinking about how this isn't the right thing. I don't agree with this. I don't want to end up doing this. He doesn't allow himself to think of that at that moment. At that moment, he's a shote, Chazal say. Chazal say, "Ein adam chote ela im kein nichnas ba ruach shtut." Every time that a person sins, a ruach of shtut, a ruach of not thinking, of not listening to what your Yetzer Tov is trying to tell you, that shtut makes you not think. And at that moment of the sin, you're just being stupid. One of the ideas of the fences and the gedarim that Chazal put in place is not only to make the sin far away from us, that it shouldn't be right in front of our face and easy, because then it's too hard to fight. Another reason why they made so many fences is that every step along the way that we have to break a fence, it's another opportunity to break out of the trance. It forces you to have to think for a second, am I going to let myself do this? Am I not going to let myself do this? And there's more of a chance that maybe you'll change your mind. It's breaking the trance and giving room for the Yetzer Tov to speak for a moment and try to stop you from the tracks of going ahead to do what you're doing. The situation that the Tanaim were all in what the Gemara is describing over here, and there's other explanations that explain the Gemara that we'll talk about later. But one of the explanations that of this Gemara, and they're all true, all the things we're going to say about the Gemara, is that they were in a situation where all the middle stages were taken away. There wasn't going to be any guilt. Nobody would ever know. There wasn't any tircha in having to do it. It was right there under the face and easy. And there was no opportunity for the Yetzer Tov to be able to speak. And at that moment, they had a second or 2 seconds to stop themselves. In each one of these cases, either Kadosh Baruch Hu came in the way and stopped it from happening, or what Rav Amram did was that he made it impossible by, with, you know, more than human strength, screaming, fire, 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 and ready to embarrass himself at his high level. He's a tremendous Rosh Hashiva and a chassid. Embarrass himself publicly in order to not let himself continue. But what was so weak about them and their situation was how easy, available, and hidden the whole thing could have been, and didn't leave any time for them not to do it. The only thing compared to that we could maybe put ourselves in that position nowadays is the internet. As I'm sure people have spoken to you in high school and elementary school and in yeshiva and stuff like that, the challenge of the internet is something that's new and unique, that's never been in all generations, in that everything Chazal did to help us and stop us from sinning is removed and taken away. There's no more getter, there's nothing more in between you and the sin anymore. It's right there, and now you don't even need to click. You could just swipe or you know, do very easy, quick movements, and it's right over there. The challenge of the internet is something that the Tanaim maybe would not have passed, as we see over here in the Gemara. I didn't make that up. I heard that from great, great people. It's something that without any boundaries and fences between the person and the sin, no one ever expected that you'd be able to face and fight a sin or a taiva or a desire that strong head on. It's bigger than us and stronger than us, and Chazal tell us the Yetzer is stronger than us. It's stronger than us, and therefore we don't stand much of a chance when we're facing the Yetzer head on. And the only way for a person really to fight those type of situations is by creating those fences again and making the end point not available so that it doesn't end up happening. Now, I want to go say something else about the Yetzer Hara, so we're going to go a little bit on a tangent. Shana Beck guys maybe heard me describe this last year in Poland. A lot of you went to Yad Vashem. Some of you are going to be going today. Hitler was extremely successful at what his plan was to do. Something that if somebody would have told you before him what he planned to do, nobody would ever think that it was going to be possible to accomplish what he did. What was the wisdom behind the final solution to kill that many millions of Jews? So if any of the Jews would have completely realized that what he planned on doing was bringing you to a gas chamber and hundreds of people, one, you know, groups after group after group after group, training them in, putting them into a room and killing them, none of the Jews would have let that happen. They would have scratched, kicked, and fought and done whatever they could, and Hitler understood that ahead of time. And if you read his writings and the description of the plan, you see that what Hitler understood that needed to be done is keep in the dark what the end goal is, what you plan on doing with them. Don't let them fully understand the plan. Tell them that you're relocating them, that you're putting them over here, while the whole time making them weaker and weaker and weaker, where their strength and their confidence are getting weaker and weaker. Then when you tell them you're putting them on trains, tell them to bring their luggage with them. They're going to need it to where they're going. Take only the things that are most important to you. Bring the pots and the pans and your clothes. And when you find the luggage that they left, you see these people planned on going to places where they thought they were going to be settling and living. We find concentration camps. We described to us that you would get there, and they would tell you, okay, you could leave the luggage on the side, or there would be a band playing there with music, never fully understanding what is it that's going on. They would see people walking around emaciated, not understanding what is this about, until all of a sudden the door was closed and they were killed completely, and then it was too late. Now that you realize what Hitler had planned on doing the entire time. The whole way through, maybe there are some voices in the beginning, early stages, saying that, oh, you know what he's going to do? He's going to try to do this, try to do that. And I was, no, what are you talking about? There's no way he plans on doing that. He would never be able to do that. And we ignore the voices in the beginning, and then step after step, boundary after boundary, he gets us to where he wanted us, and he suffocates us to death. The Gemara says, Hu Satan, Hu Yetzahara, Hu Malach HaMavet. The Yetzahara is the Satan, he's the Malach HaMavet, the one that kills us at the end of the day. The Yetzahara acts like he's our friend. He smiles at us and beckons to us and tells us, do this, this is going to be fun, this is going to bring you pleasure, you want pleasure, it's going to be really good. And he lies to us, and he tricks us, and he lures us in and brings us to places that in the beginning, we never would have wanted to get to those places, but he knew how to work with us because he understands us and knows that he has to work at each step from the early stages. And the voices inside of us saying, no, he's not real. I would never happen to me. I would never do such and such. I would never. I would end up stopping by this point. Then I would end up fighting. So those voices are ignored, because he's doing it so slowly, before it's too late and a person finds himself in a place that he can't dig himself out of and get himself out of. That is the pattern of the Yetzer Hara. He's progressive. The Gemara tells us, today he tells you to do this, the next day he tells you to do this, finally he gets you to serve Avodah Zarah. So if you were to see in front of your face where he's going to bring you to, you never would have done that. So one of the ways of fighting the Yetzer Hara is to present in front of ourselves where it ends up leading to, what it ends up accomplishing, so the person doesn't fall prey towards blindlessly falling one little thing after the other. We all know how it is because we've succumbed to running after pleasures so many times in our life. We're told that, oh, you're going to enjoy that, it's going to feel good. And the second it happens, either while it's happening or the second that it's over, it no longer feels good anymore. It actually feels pretty bad. We feel emptier, we feel dirty, we feel guilty, and it hurts more than the pain that it would have hurt to stop ourselves originally from doing that thing. We beat ourselves up again, and often because we feel so weak and we feel so down and beaten up, in order to, we feed ourselves again, that thing that gives us a short amount of pleasure. But it's clearly not our friend because it's never satisfied. After you get used to one thing, then you want it to be more. After you get used to that, then you want it to be more. And it keeps again until it gets you to points that in a million, you never even had a taiva for that. Originally, you never wanted that. You never even thought about that. And all of a sudden, you find that all the other things are no longer interesting to you. They're no longer exciting for you. And it wants something more. Chazal described this, describe the pleasure of this world as drinking salty water, drinking the water of an ocean. You're so thirsty, you're dying of thirst, you can't not drink, and you drink the ocean water, and maybe while it's in your mouth you think you're quenching yourself, but you're only even more thirsty than you were before. It never actually makes you happy. We don't find by animals that animals run after worldly pleasures the way that we do. They eat what they need and they're finished. They don't get addicted to things naturally on their own, unless maybe somebody's doing a test on them in some laboratory. They don't chase after things. They don't get drunk. They don't take drugs. They don't get addicted to things. If they have relations, when they're going to have children, and they don't have it obsessively for no reason whatsoever. And I don't think, and I never looked into it, but I don't think that they sit and they daydream about having relations with other animals. So why is it that we find that by human beings this deep pull and draw after the worldly pleasures that don't find anything logical to it and continues to fill itself and run after things that don't end up making it feel good? It's self-destructive. According to Darwin or whatever, it's not something that logically makes sense. It doesn't make you survive better. It's not healthy. It ruins people's lives and it's not productive in any kind of a way. Why does it happen to human beings, this retarded, ridiculous cycle? So they explain that the neshama that's in us really yearns and wants connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu, which is Netzach, which is eternity. It wants complete and ultimate and eternal goodness to no end whatsoever. So we have pinings and drawings from within our neshama, wanting something greater, wanting something that's good, that's pleasurable, that's unbelievable, and we misinterpret those pinings and direct it to go for things that are cheaper, easier, quicker, and don't require any effort. And then we don't feel any fuller because it wasn't really what we're meant to be running after, and instead we do it again and again and again, and that's how we become addictive in a way that animals don't, because we have a neshama and the animals don't have a neshama. By the way, that's another reason why there's a Chazal say, "Kala gadol mechaveru yitzor gadol himenu." The greater that you are, whoever's a greater person, his Yetzirah is even stronger. Why? Because the bigger your neshama, the stronger the yearnings and the pullings are, that it wants to be attached to something unbelievable and great and eternal, and therefore the struggle that the Gedolim will have, or the Tanaim, their pull will be even stronger, if you can imagine, than the pull that we would have. Eber katan yesh ba'adam masbio ra'ev mar'ivo saveya. If you satiate it, then it gets only more hungry. It wants only more. If you fill in your desires, then you only want more. You're only hungrier, and the pain of your desire gets only stronger, and you're chasing after something that you're never going to reach. The quote that often people like to say is, once is too much, 1,000 times is never enough. The first time that you click on it is usually an accident. The second time often comes out of curiosity to see again things similar to what you saw the first time by accident. And very quickly that curiosity turns into something that you're having a difficult time clicking on and looking at, much longer than you had planned to originally when you look at the first time out of curiosity. One time is too much, 1,000 times is never enough. One of the things a person is meant to think to himself when he feels coming upon himself that he wants this thing that's pleasurable is to tell himself, wait, either way I'm going to feel pain. Either I'm going to feel the pain of holding myself back and not letting myself do blank, or I'm going to feel the other pain of how terrible I feel afterwards, and it's going to pull me to do it again and feel an even stronger pain. It's either the pain of building oneself and growing and slowly leading towards more happiness and feeling free and in control of oneself, or it's the pain that leads to more pain and more pain and more pain. We find ourselves, we fall, what the Yetzer Hara does to us, we fall into self-destructive behavior. We afflict our own selves, and we're our own worst enemy in the behaviors that we have. The reason, one of the things that drive me so much to want to speak about this is because there's almost not any, I think, yeshiva student, and this isn't just Torah Trag, I imagine this is any yeshiva and anybody that has any type of exposure to the internet. But whenever I start a conversation with any alumni from any year, whether they're married with children, or they're younger, or they're a student, or whatever it is, if they don't have an internet filter, then as soon as you start talking about the different things that are on the internet, usually they'll start to look away and feel uncomfortable. And if you raise the conversation in a way that they feel very comfortable, then they have a lot what to say, and a lot what to talk about, and a lot what to describe, and a lot of help that they're seeking, and they were too embarrassed to speak up. It's so all over the place that it's really terrifying and it's scary. I know people and students who may end up hearing this year will think that I'm referring to them, and I'm probably referring to somebody else. But there are students that end up from all yeshivas, because they also describe to me the types of people they meet in these places, that get to the point of rehabilitation centers within a short time after leaving Israel. It happens very fast, it happens very quick, and it's worse than what you could really imagine. We are especially prone to it, single guys, because when somebody is married and holding a job, he is so much more at risk, so much more at stake, so much more that he's embarrassed about, where even though it's afflicting everybody and even them too, but there's at least something, an incentive to want to work on it, constantly making them fight it. When you really don't have much at risk at this stage in our life, because there's nobody really to be disappointed in us, we don't share our phone or our computer with anybody, we're not going to lose a marriage, we're not going to embarrass ourselves to our children or lose our jobs or anything like that, so there's much less incentive to want to work on these things. And often the misconception that people say to themselves is, well, when I get married and I have a healthy outlet for these type of things, then it's going to be better and I'll work on it then. And those people are endangering themselves and their wife, because they will not have a good marriage. And chances are they will get divorced. If you look at statistics, most religious Jewish couples that are getting divorced nowadays are because of one of the couple, usually the man, having addictive behaviors on the computer, looking at pornographic sites, and at some point or other, being caught by his wife. I want to describe it even worse, though, because, like we said, that the Yetzer isn't satisfied. He always wants the next thing. He wants something further. Nowadays, it's so common I don't know how much you know about, how much you know, but maybe you know even more than I know, or maybe it's only yet to come in the future. But a lot of them leave the internet and start doing things real in actual life that in a million years they would have been horrified to even think or imagine they would do the things that they're doing. And even in that stage of the process, they never would think that they would get to that. At a certain point, they lose all belief and trust in themselves, and they completely let go. This leads to a few people having told me that they wish they were dead, and they've contemplated suicide, and a lot of divorces, and people becoming not religious because they can't live with themselves, and they're conscious, and not becoming religious doesn't make them any happier. So this is a very destructive thing that no generation until now has ever been exposed to. In the annual report on pornography statistics for 2013, they say the following. 1 in 5 mobile phone searches are used for pornography. 1 second, $3,075 are spent on pornography. And 90% of the pornography that's on the internet is for free. So that $3,075 a second that's spent is only reflective of the 10% that's looked at. 12% of all websites are pornographic. 9 out of 10 males are exposed to pornography before the age of 18. 1/3 of them say that they viewed too many pornographic videos that they could even count. 15% of boys have seen child pornography before the age of 18. Before 18, they viewed child pornography, 15% of the population. I saw a quote pointed out from a sociologist named Jill Manning. What's even more disturbing is the fact that the first internet generations have not reached full maturity. So the upper limits of this impact have yet to be realized. These people that are exposed to what we're describing over here aren't even in their 20s and 30s yet for us to be able to see what type of effect on the generation this is going to have. Matrimonial something in America, they said that right now 56% of divorces are because of one of the spouses that are acting out in that kind of a way. The amount of people that have addictions to child pornography and are interested in children is way beyond what it used to be, and clearly, and they'll describe it themselves, that it's sourced in following lust after lust after lust, where they got interested in things that they never would have thought they would have gotten interested in. The amount of people that are interested in same-sex relationships are way much greater than what they used to be. What the eye sees, the eye begins to want. And things that they don't see, they never even think of wanting. One of the things that could happen that we kind of described, Chazal say, is that you do a sin a certain number of times, and then in your mind, it becomes like it's mutter. You're not even fighting it anymore. You've learned helplessness. You've given up the fight, and now you just look at it as something mutter. They're not fighting. Some people might have already long ago decided that this isn't a battle that I could fight. I don't really have any way. I'm not going to win this battle, and they give up. By the way, a lot of the alumni described to me, I said, what happened when you were in Torah Traga? What happened while you were in yeshiva? So some of them said they continued the entire time they were in yeshiva. Some people said they had ups and downs. Some people said that before yeshiva they struggled with it. They hoped that after yeshiva they wouldn't anymore, and then they did. And sometimes it was immediate, and sometimes it was a few months later. Some people it starts only 4 or 5 years later. But I want to just explain a little bit more, though, what generation that we're living in, and put a little bit more of a positive and spin on it, and explain why this was specifically meant for the generation before the days of the Mashiach. The same way that the Yetzer Hara works with us personally that way, progressively one thing after the other, lowering boundary after boundary, it works like that over the generations. When we talk about Yiridas HaDoros, one of the ideas of Yiridas HaDoros is that the Yetzer Hara, over the years, has accomplished a lot throughout the centuries, getting people to do more and more, worse and worse. If you would take people from 50, 60, 70 years ago and look at what people are exposed to today, they would all be horrified, uncomfortable, and not be okay with it. The violence that's in the movies, you all know, have gotten worse over the years, and the pornography and what is okay on television and in the computers has completely deteriorated to mind-boggling levels that you're more maybe okay or used to, because this is what you've always seen, what you've been used to, but anybody that's lived, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago and saw what was then, it still could be shocking to what people are. That's how the Satan works with people in general. And the same way that the Yetzer makes a person think that something is mutter, they can make an entire generation think and be okay that something is mutter. One thing that's really scary is that in the world opinion, I looked at the annual report on pornography statistics for 2013, and 3 out of 5 men think that viewing pornography is acceptable. The world that you're going into, most people, and it's going to only become more, think that it's completely normal and okay, something that is extremely damaging, unsatisfying, and will continue to lower you and ruin your life, as children that found that their fathers were looking at it or saw it on the history of their father's computers and didn't understand, what am I supposed to do now? I tell my mother, I don't tell my mother. Tzidkas HaTzadik, Rav Tzadok HaKohen, describes the following situation. We said that Kala Gadol Mechaveiro Yitzor Gadol Himenu. Therefore, if somebody finds that they have an extremely difficult taiva or challenge, it's a compliment in a way from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because the greater the Yetzirah, that's reflective of how great the person is, how great the potential is, and how big the neshama is. The Tzidkas HaTzadik says that in the Zohar, the generation of the Mabul, the generation of Matan Torah, and the generation of Yemos HaMashiach are all the same neshamos. The neshamos that were alive in the days of the Mabul are the neshamos that were alive at the time of Matan Torah, and they're the neshamos that are before the days of Mashiach. The Gemara says that the reason why they drowned in the water was they were boiling in thick water, that was because of all the seed that was spilled during that generation. That was a falling and a failure on their part. The Zohar says that the Tzidkas HaTzadik says that the Torah was meant and could have been given during the generation of the Mabul, and they misdirected the pinings of their soul and went after the taiva of being Motzi Zera Levatala that led towards their downfall. Matan Torah didn't fall after that. Instead, they were drawn after the pinings of their soul, ran after Hashem in the Midbar, received the Torah, and reached tremendous heights. The days before the Mashiach comes, it says by Rav Tzadok HaKohen, is going to, and I saw this by the Chafetz Chaim also, the author of the Mishnah Berurah writes this in Tzapita LeYeshua, that the generation before the Mashiach is going to be mixed with a strong pull in both directions. Both a pull from the neshama towards the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and in the worst way ever, that those neshamas pulling the generation, the people of the generation, down to the lowest depths, like right before Yetzias Mitzrayim, the 49th, 50th level of Tumah. And the reason for that is because the greatest Kiddush Hashem and the greatest Kavod Shemayim that could be is that when you're in the deepest depths, entrenched in garbage and desire and nothingness, to then recognize and see a Kadosh Baruch Hu and pull oneself out of it creates the greatest Kiddush Hashem that could bring about the days of the Mashiach. I heard a beautiful mashal about our generation. They ask, how is it that the earlier generations, with all their Kedusha and their Torah learning and the Yir Shemayim and their Shmiras and Mitzvos, if they weren't able to bring the Mashiach, how are we going to be able to bring the Mashiach? So far, so deep in mud, how are we going to bring the Mashiach? So I heard a mashal. Somebody goes to a parrot store and he wants to buy a parrot, and he's asking the storekeeper about what the different prices are of the different parrots that are in the store. So he looks at one parrot and he says, oh, how much is that parrot? Oh, that's a very pretty parrot. Very nice colors. It's about $300-$400, sir. Oh, okay. And how much is this parrot? Oh, that parrot, he has like a whole list of sentences that he's able to say. That costs more. That parrot is around $1,000, $1,500. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, how much is that parrot worth? Oh, I'm sorry, sir. You would never be able to afford that parrot. No. How much is that parrot worth? That parrot actually is worth $500,000. $500,000 for a parrot? Yeah, well, that parrot is able to sing the entire Lecha Dodi from beginning to end to the breast of Renigan. So what? I'm also able to sing the entire Lecha Dodi to the breast of Renigan. I was never offered $500,000 to do that. That's a silly taina. Why? Because for a human being to sing the entire Lecha Dodi is not such a big deal. But for a parrot to be trained to know every single word and sing on key to the tune of the breast of Renigan, the entire Lecha Dodi, is a huge accomplishment. So too, our generation, the little bit that we are able to accomplish and get ourselves to do and hold ourselves back from doing the things that we're drawn so strongly after is worth so much. To get a parrot, to get somebody so distant from their neshama to do anything is worth that much more. I thought of another mashal. When a parent has a special needs child, So sometimes they hit their developmental stages much, much later than a regular healthy child. Sometimes you could have an 11 or 12-year-old, Rahmanul Islam, only be able to turn over or sit up or stand or walk when they're 12 or 13 years old. When they're 15, they say their first word or their first bracha they're able to say. And you see that these parents are overcome with nachas for their child. They cry from joy and happiness over what their child was able to accomplish. And somebody looking at them would say, what are you so excited about? What are you getting so much nachas from? Why are you so proud and happy? Why do you have such a good feeling in your heart? They're so old. That's all they're doing. They're saying a bracha. They're turning over. They're saying their first word. But where is the parent's nachas coming from? The parent understands their child's capabilities. And they understand what's difficult for them and what they're capable of and what comes very, very, very hard for them. And they understand the amount of work and effort that went in for them to accomplish that which they accomplished. And that's what the parents are proud of, and that's what they're getting their nachas from. When their child is able to say their first bracha, their first word, or turn over, despite how old they are when it happens, the parents are beaming with pride and joy and happiness, and small. It takes much less to make the kids get nachas, to make the parents have nachas from their children. That's like a Kadosh Baruch Hu with us in our generation. The harder a challenge is, the more valuable that it is. And since we live in a generation where it's so easy just to click on things and run after them, when somebody does stay away from it, for every click, we're bringing tremendous bracha and tremendous good blessing into the world. We said this is something that the Tanaim may not have been able to pass such a test like that. If we're in the test, that means that we could. But the only way that we could pass such a test we're going to talk about is doing what the Yetzer doesn't want us to do most, which is one, what we tried to do right now, which is put the end of the road in front of your face and realize that it does happen and it is happening. It's happening to most people who don't use filters on their phones and on their internet at home and at work. And if I would read you the statistics, it's terrible. 9 out of 10 men said they use it, they're looking at internet at least once or twice a week. Pornography. A third of the men of the world say they look at it too often that they can't even count on their hand how often that they're looking at it. We're no different just because we're Jewish. We have the same machines and the same titles that they have. Our neshamas are stronger, so who knows if maybe even chas v'shalom that it's worse by us. It's the 50% of the people said that they were exposed to pornography before the age of 12. And 15% of boys have viewed child pornography before the age of 18. So it's really sick what's going on out there that we need to save ourselves from. Since every little thing that we do is so valuable right now, any little time that you hold yourself back from a little thing, so it's worth so much because the pain to fight against it is so strong. Therefore, the Yetzer ends up fighting us even stronger and making it even more available and even more hard to stay away from. And therefore, it makes it even more valuable every time that we fight with it. It's ridiculous from the Rebbeim's perspective when you look at how intense the distractions are of this generation, that we're all slaves, literally slaves. I think a lot of you, if you're mature enough, would admit that you're a slave, and those who are not, you know, you just don't want to accept it. But we're slaves to the distractions that are inside our phone to a ridiculous, ridiculous extent. Why is it that the Yitzhahara is like that? Because since every good thing that we do is worth so much that it could bring the Mashiach nowadays, they want to stop you from even a second of learning, even a minute of learning, because it's so valuable. So they heap upon, the Yitzhahara heaps upon the distraction so much, you shouldn't even stop for a second because it's so powerful every time that you do. The greatest way that we could take a knife and stab the Yitzhahara in his chest is to be smart and realize, I cannot do it on my own. If I'm in face of a sin, I'll click on it today, or I'll click on it tomorrow, or I'll click on it next week. I'm not going to trust myself. I'm not willing to fall on the path that the majority of the population is falling on to a destructive and terrible extent. And therefore, I'm going to put filters on my phone and on my computers at home, at work, in yeshiva. Everything that I own is going to have a strong filter. A filter means I don't know how to get around it. If you know how to get around it, that's not a filter. Often, filters aren't even enough, and you need other things too. There's a bunch of guys in YU that on their own asked me and maybe some of the other Rebbeim to do something called Web Chaver, where if they go to any inappropriate site, it would be sent to my email, and therefore that is enough. The embarrassment that they would feel is enough that keeps them from doing certain things. And if somebody doesn't, they are going to fall. They're going to fall. Nobody here, it takes gaiva and self-righteousness to think that you're better than 90-something percent of the world, that for the rest of your life you're going to stay strong to this. And if you think that it's okay, then why is it that you wouldn't want your parents to know about this or see this, or wouldn't want your wife to know about it? And would you want your kids to be doing and involved in the things that you're doing? And therefore, we are stuck sometimes in behaviors that hurt ourselves and afflict ourselves, and any fight that we do could be bringing the Mashiach. So what I really wanted to bring an awareness to this, I wanted to give out a page that says different type of filters based on the different type of phones that you have. You could download immediately onto your phones or iPads or iPhones or whatever it is. There's tons of things. There's a couple of important websites that everybody should know about. One is called guardyoureyes.com that I wrote this on, which is a lot of the Gedolim and a lot of Rabbanim and psychologists say it's the only way the Jewish people really have now to fight against a lot of these type of behaviors. And I printed out, they have a booklet. I printed it out and I went to a store and I had it bound. First page is falling off, sorry. But it's called the GYE Handbook, the Guard Your Eyes Handbook. Basically, everybody is holding at a different stage within the process of falling. You wouldn't even know whether you're considered addicted or not addicted. And even if you're not addicted, every single person without filters are a potential to become addicted in a short amount of time. So even if you've never done anything, which I don't think that's true for 100% of the people in this room, that if you've never done anything at all, then this still pertains to you. We're going to leave it around in the base. Anybody that wants their own copy, it's for free to print it off of any computer. Nobody should feel embarrassed to read this in public. You should feel embarrassed that you didn't read it. Everybody should read this. It doesn't mean that you have a problem. It means that you acknowledge that there's a problem in the world, and therefore I want to read it, and I want to also think about, I'm going to have children in 4 or 5 years from now. I want to understand what I should and shouldn't have in my home. And to be aware, the only way, you're going to have friends. One of your roommates or the guy next to you is going to be very deeply involved in pornography. A lot of people that you know will get divorced or have difficult marriages over it. That is happening, and we're ignoring it if we don't. It's too spread that to ignore that the case. So therefore, if you read this, you at least could help the people that are around you by knowing what to say to them and what could help them. This talks about every step along the way that somebody might be holding out. It's not just for people that are holding deep in an addiction. It shows you, it gives you very clear guidelines to know where along the process that you are, and it only does involvement and gives you ideas based on how deeply into the process you are. So this will be right behind my makom in our English section of the base midrash. Don't take it out of the base midrash. Only read it in and always put it back there when you're finished. You should feel proud to be reading it. One thing I would ask is the following, and I think that it's something that we could all do. When you give up on something or let go of something that's very difficult for you, and you feel very deeply personally connected and a drive towards, so you're giving a korban to Hashem, and it's extremely powerful, and doing that, b'schus something, or if you daven right afterwards, it has tremendous ability to accomplish things. Especially because we all know the Gemara in Shabbos that says that areas of Gili Arayos, the things that we put in front of our eyes, creates a tremendous danger, especially to the children of Klal Yisrael. And as we have seen recently, there have been a lot of terrible and tragic deaths and tragedies that have happened in many families. And therefore, when I'm going to pass this around, I hope, and my expectation, what I would want, and I think what anybody, if you're normal, you'll do. So you will download a filter, a heavy one. If it needs a code, you have your friend put the code in for you, because if you know the code, it's not a filter. And we'll do it for the Refuah Shlema of Chaim Michal Shlomo ben Michal and Refuah Yitzhak Isaac ben Michal, and also Binyamin Ovadia ben Talia Miriam, I think. Bentaya Miriam. We will do it that they should have an immediate refuah. Anybody who downloads it, you're giving a korban for their refuah, and you're saving yourself, your children, your life, your sanity, and you're opening yourself up to be able to be a healthy, normal human being, and you're bringing the Mashiach. There is a website called vinishmartem.com. Vinishmartem, V-E-N-I-S-H-M-A-R TEM.com, Vinishmartem.com. If you click on it, then they give you an option for them to identify your phone or your computer. And when they identify it, then they can give you a list of four or five different ideas of filters that you might want to use, and they describe what each one would do and wouldn't do. Different people have different things that they're willing to put or do on their phone in terms of filters, and this will give you some of the different options. I recommend everybody checking out that website, vinishmartem.com. Another popular type of filter that guys in Torah Chraga have used is K9, the letter K and the number 9. And somebody else would have your code, somebody that's near you. So if there's ever any websites you want added to what you're able to get to, they could type in the code and add those websites. But I definitely recommend checking these things out as soon as possible. Often a person pushes off and plans to do this later on and never ends up getting around to it.